When chaos begins to emerge in our world, where can we go to remind ourselves of hopeful humans that are helping to create a more compassionate world? Each month in the Restorative Pulse podcast, tune in as we feature thought leaders creating innovative change in our world and in our systems, from the macro level to the micro level, in our schools, healing spaces, and beyond. I'm Julie Johnson, founder of Integrate Network, and this is the Restorative Pulse podcast.
Hey everyone, it's Julie Johnson, founder of Integrate Network, and this is the Restorative Pulse podcast, and we are talking today again with Carl Helbert, the grief activist and grief counselor and yoga therapist, who talked with us a little bit more the first time about the koshas in grief, which was kind of the yoga, the model of yoga, and how we had this like pre-existing model of how to work with grief through the koshas, which was awesome, right? And now we're talking more about what another thing we're talking about a lot of, which is like my second breath, which is inclusion. It's like, that's like the next breath I take is like what I know, which is inclusion work and diversity and inclusion. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about grief and, autism though, through her book, the, what's the name? What's the first title of it? Finding Your Own Way to Grieve. And I love it because, you know, one thing, you know, we talk about on the platform a lot is, you know, learning to social emotional inclusion for people's experiences, right? And I think that I love this integration of neurodiversity and grief here because it goes hand in hand with what we're talking about. It's like, not only are we exploring how to bring bodies, different bodies and different experiences together, but how to see them, right? So anyway, Carla, I don't mean to like take her, but that's like kind of where my head is all the time right now these days, so.
That's okay. I really like listening to you talk, so.
Yeah. So I would love to hear more about your perspective on, you know, neurodiversity. Sure. And, you know, us, you know, concepts of grief from your understanding of it and your experiences.
Well, I mean, so you mentioned the book, and I have it, I've got it right here. And so this is the book.
I probably read it before I came downstairs.
But I wrote this book. I mean, this is the fact that you're talking about inclusion is really like why this book even exists. Like before I wrote the book, in about 2001, I was working in a private school for kids with developmental disabilities. And this kid came in and he was new to me. So I was learning some things about him, and he had recently lost both of his grandfathers. And one of his grandfathers was like his person, and it was really hard for him. And so I was doing some research and trying to find some things on autism and grief, and there was literally nothing. Nothing, like there was nothing on autism and grief. And I thought, oh my God, what do I do? And so I wrote him this little story. This sort of reads like a poem, but it's the opening to the book. And I don't remember when I wrote the book. I think I wrote this book in, I think it was published in 2014. But at that time, what I did was write this little, and it's how the book opens really. It's this little short story when people die. And then the book is like sort of like stanzas. I talk about different things throughout the little story. And then the book is broken down into chapters that further delve into those sort of areas. Mm-hmm. But I was like so shocked that there was nothing out there for me to use as a resource with him. And he really loved that story. And the little story like ended up being used by a lot of people. And then it turned into this book. But yeah, if things are a little better now, but it's still really, you know, not talked about much. I mean, in grief in general, we are sort of in this movement now. And social media is such a double-edged sword. Like in some ways for grieving people, it's very difficult. Social media is. In other ways, it's been a great way for people to connect. And then to see that, you know, your feelings and your experiences that you're going through are very, very normal. So it's been a way to normalize. And I think because of that, there's much more access to resources and support groups, even, you know, virtual ones. And you do have to be careful, but even still with all of that, you know, changing. So this is like 20 years later from the time I first met him, there's still not that much.
Right.
And so we're talking about a population of people that isn't huge. And grieving people are also sort of an isolated population. So you put those two together and then you have people who even have less support and understanding. So right. I really appreciate doing this show today because it's this podcast. It's really great. I'm glad we're talking about it.
Yeah. And one thing I really like that other people have brought up who've been looking at your book that come to my attention is people are like, oh, well, this, even though I'm, you know, I have a background or I have CPTSD and I'm a teacher or I'm an adult, I still find that like I have little, you know, this is like IFS work or internal family systems work, which is a therapy that you have where you kind of go within. I feel like I can't ever like describe it in a way that doesn't sound weird, that whole thing, but like,
well, it like breaks us down into parts, like each part of ourselves, because we've all said this, like, well, there's a part of me that wants to do this and there's a part of me. So it looks at what are those parts and then how you kind of carry around that whole system inside of you. And each part of us kind of does a job. It has its own role, that kind of way of looking at it.
Yeah. And so I know that people are like, oh, I have these child parts, you know, these are people that are like our therapist, IFS therapists, or also have gone through the therapy who've said like, oh, that part, I could do parts work with that work. So that's, people have said that to me after I posted that. So I was like, yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, it is true. I mean, it's written at like a sixth grade level. But you know, a lot of Hemingway's works were written at a fourth grade level, meaning that they're so easy to understand. Like the sentences aren't long and complex. They're easy to understand. And even if you don't have autism, you can benefit from just how this book is very concrete and very inclusive. It talks about things in a very matter of fact way, explains things like how you might be feeling and lots of different stuff like that. I mean, I love, like, I use children's books with grown people all the time, you know, and there's such, well, I think we said right before we started recording, you were talking about de-intellectualizing these concepts, and that's what it is. And because we can intellectualize about grief and all sorts of different clinical aspects of lots of things, but when you're going through it, it's not an intellectual exercise. It is your life.
Totally. Yeah, 110%. And I think that you bring up a really good point in that, what was I going to say? In that I think when we de-intellectualize it, we kind of start to move away from looking at like all these grief models, and we start to look at what you said, this very simplified, like childlike perspective of it. That's really like when we think about when we lose something, you know, like, I don't know about you, but I mean, and I'll just go from my own experience. I'm like, I know I kind of have to like, I kind of notice these very like survival level responses when I've gone through deep loss on all different, whether it's whatever the type is, whatever it is. I know for me, I kind of have to like go back to these very primal things that I learned as a kid, you know, and even as an adult, you know, going through loss. And then I have to kind of work my coping skills from there. And that's what I love about that book, because I feel like when anyone goes into grief, they kind of, they do go into a little bit of a survival mode, you know, that you know?
Yes.
And so that's what I love about it. So that's why I think it's really great. It's universal. And that's one thing I love, even as someone that writes on hard topics now, I guess these days I blog on a lot of tough topics for other platforms as well. And, you know, one thing I always say is I'm like, we have to keep this really simple, you know, because we don't have a lot of language around things. Like I said, parts work is really hard, because I'm always like, I have to like put it in so many terms, because it's kind of an esoteric concept. But and grief, you know, it's like we have to keep it really simple, because I think we can say that I think a lot of us go into survival responses when it comes to loss or change of any kind, you know, and we kind of have to work with our coping tools, which is what your book's about, is working with that. And it's good for anyone with any, on any level, right? And that's what makes it great. Cause sometimes, like, let's be honest, for those of us that have had to go through a lot of loss, like sixth grade level might be where we're at, and we might be 45, right. You know?
Oh, totally. Yes. And I appreciate
that. That might be where we are in our limbic brain.
Yeah. Well, and I also like where you said, well, yes, because we do go into that limbic brain place, like you said, primal responses. Mm-hmm. I'll just talk right now about, we don't have to just talk about death of a person. If you think about loss of a home, mm-hmm. loss of your job, loss of mm-hmm. a friendship, like all of these things are those really primal things that really get you down on Maslow's, you know, hierarchy of needs, survival mm-hmm. needs. So, and when you lose somebody really important, like say your mom, mm-hmm. and it doesn't matter how old you are, like you said, like I've seen so many grown people who lose their mothers, and it does depend on your relationship with this person, of course. Mm-hmm. But right. It feels you're like a child again, right? You've lost mm-hmm. your mom, and it doesn't matter how old you are. Same thing with when you lose a child, like it doesn't matter how old that child is. Mm-hmm. It still affects you, and it's a survival. And I really have thought about this a lot in terms of traumatic grief, especially, but some of it translates over into that sort of primal state, but that, you know, how we have these post-traumatic responses around grief. And unless, you know, if you're with the person at the moment of their death and your life was also potentially in danger, most of the time our lives were not also in danger, but we experience those post-traumatic stress responses as though they were. And I've thought about this a lot, and, you know, you really get down to it. We have not, our brains and bodies have not changed in 100,000 years, and we still operate like we did then when we all lived in tribes. And if you lose someone, then everybody is in danger to a degree. Right. And the closer you are to your like core circle of people, the more danger you're in. If you lose your spouse, your partner, your helpmate in life of, you know, gathering food and keeping your little unit alive, you're then threatened. If somebody in the tribe has a disease, then everybody's potentially threatened. If you're a child and you lose your parent, you're threatened. If you are a parent and your child dies, your literal biological line might be threatened at a level of DNA, a cellular level. And I've certainly talked to a lot of bereaved parents and experienced it myself. It changes you on a cellular level. And I think that's why it's that limbic system response of fear and danger. And that's a very embodied sort of experience. And that's how it feels. You know, you're not intellectualizing this. You're in it.
Right. And I think, you know, one thing, you know, I think that, you know, for people that are, I think on the neurodiversity piece, it's experiential, right? Like, that's one thing I think that why we probably misunderstand grief in general, the fact that we even misunderstand grief for people with, you know, on the autism spectrum, you know, the fact that we don't even consider that tells you where we are in our relationship and our understanding of grief as a society, mm-hmm. you know? And so, yeah.
Well, you know, I've worked with people on the autism spectrum for over 20 years now, which is like, it's crazy to me, but whatever, it's true. And, you know, in my experience, all of the sort of, well, I won't say all, a lot of the challenges that people with ASD experience are made far more magnified under stress. Mm-hmm. And this is also true of people who are grieving. Grief itself is a stressor. Like it is a huge stressor in your life, you know, for many reasons, whether, you know, you're dealing with the traumatic piece of it, potentially, if it's a traumatic loss, or, you know, all of the other things you have to adjust to. I mean, there's the death of that person, and then all of that encompasses, you know, the trying to like reconcile this idea, which we can't even really, you know, early on in grief, that they're gone, because it doesn't feel that way. I mean, our brains, it takes our brains some time to get used to the fact that they aren't here anymore. And we continue to sort of behave as though they are, because that's how our life has been. Oh, let me call. I got to call her and tell her about this. You can't call her and tell her, you know, or your routine is thrown off. All of these things that happen as we try to adjust to this, you know, shockingly new way of trying to exist And we don't want to be learning how to adjust to this because it's not what we want. Like everything in us is like railing against this as reality. It's a huge amount of stress. And, you know, all of the things that people with autism may be dealing with in general are made, you know, much more, and there's grief on top of that. It can cause a lot of distress. I mean, it feels like there's so much to say. And, you know, last time you and I talked, we also talked a little bit about disenfranchised grief. And that's another thing that comes into play with this population. Also, depending on, how they present in the world and how much support they may need around them, whether they, you know, communicate verbally or not, all sorts of different things. People have these ideas about what they may or may not be experiencing. And very often, a lot of times, especially people who are, you know, more, I guess I hate those terms, higher and low functioning, but people who need more external support, I would like to say, and potentially people who are verbally, do not communicate with words and verbal, in verbal ways. Often it's assumed that they're not grieving, and that's just not true. I mean, it also, if you work with any autistic kids at all, I mean, just sometimes a change in the schedule, a small change like, oh, lunchtime is going to be different, can throw off their day entirely. So here's like, oh, somebody important has died, or one day they go to get on the bus and their bus driver is not there, and maybe they were friends with that bus driver and nobody tells them what happened to the bus driver. That can be a loss, you know. So it's very misunderstood, and the grief of somebody on the autism spectrum can be vastly underestimated, you know, or just thinking, well, they're not expressing that they're grieving, they may not express it the same way that you do or I do. And even if they do communicate verbally, they may not be able to, I mean, I know neurotypical people who don't have the words to communicate what they're feeling in grief, you know, so this population often gets put, you know, put in this disenfranchised group also. And that is a grief that's not seen or validated by society. Or losses that are not seen or validated by society for lots of different reasons. But people who have disabilities often have disenfranchised grief because people just don't think they can grieve like other people. And then there's that bizarre myth around people with autism not having empathy, which is just so not true. Like it's they're overly empathetic in a lot of ways. Right. So, you know, that's the piece of it. Their grief may not even be seen, much less addressed or held by someone else, because they may not look like they're grieving, whatever that looks like.
No, I think that you bring up how grief looks, right? Because we talked about that in our last podcast. I think how have you seen grief, like in people you've worked with, how have you seen grief manifested?
Do you mean with people on the spectrum or do you mean people in general?
No, people on the spectrum. Like, I mean, like I just want to bring to light the book and stuff like that. So like your experiences within that, I realize like can you show us a picture of like how that might look for someone that this is new for?
Well, I mean, you know, Stephen Shore, who's a speaker and an author and a lot of things who has autism, has said that if you meet one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. And that is so true. If you meet one person in grief, you've met this one person in grief. And what we see a lot now, there's a lot of validation around the fact that grief is highly individual, completely unique to each person. And so that's also true of somebody who is autistic and how that might look and how it might manifest. Now, you know, I have in my entire career of working with people on the spectrum, I've never met one person with autism who does not have some challenges in communication, social interactions, and also sensory perception issues, right? Sensory overwhelm. And that looks different for every person too. And I will say, so when you're in grief, and this is true for neurotypical people too, depending on the level of grief, it happened to me and it was amazing. it gave me a lot of insight into people with autism who I'd already worked with, but then, you know, take it a step further, people in grief. But I had so many sensory problems. Like, I could not deal with loud noises. I could not, God forbid, take me into a Walmart or a big box store. I could not deal with the sensory overwhelm. The lights were too bright. There were too many people. There was too much noise. I couldn't process it. My fine motor skills were not good. I dropped things a lot. I ran into things. And I had sensory processing problems for a long time. And another really weird thing that I really don't even understand completely is I had problems looking people in the eye. Like, I could not maintain eye contact. And I'm not saying that's the same thing for somebody who has autism and experiences those sensory things. What I am saying is that if they're also grieving, those things are going to be magnified potentially. And also being on the lookout for new sensory perception changes, new sensory processing changes, because it can happen that there's, I got an email from somebody, I still to this day don't know how she got my information, but she wrote me an email. It was after the book hadn't been published yet, but it was done. It was like in process. She's like, I hear that you're writing a book about autism and grief, and I want to talk about my experiences. She was an adult person. Well, she still is an adult person. And her father died, and she was present at his death. He died of a heart attack in front of her, and it was very traumatic. And she went to a grief counselor who thankfully, you know, also had experience in autism. And through that experience is where she got her diagnosis of autism. But one of the things she talked about is how she never noticed her visual sensory processing issues at all. But when she was in grief, she could notice even like the bark on a tree was so vivid, and it was like it was moving for her that she couldn't take her eyes off of it. She was like fascinated by it, and the asphalt on the ground, and she was scared. But these things, that her traumatic grief triggered even more sensory issues for her and communication problems for her. So it was very interesting that her grief led to her autism diagnosis, which, you know, wasn't new, but nobody had told her. You know, she was a late in life adult diagnosis person. And I just thought that was very interesting because I understood that, not to the degree that she was experiencing it, because I didn't have that same sort of neurodiversity or however, you know, her sensory system is processing things, but it triggered new responses for her that were overwhelming.
Right. So,
looking out for that. And then, you know, just in talking about kids, especially, a lot of kids on the spectrum have, and some adults too. I mean, I've worked with adults who still have issues with eating, being able to pay attention to body cues. And that's a sensory thing too. Knowing when you're hungry, knowing when you're tired, knowing when you're thirsty, you know, so if people are around this person, paying close attention to that too, because you might see more problems in feeding issues or food issues. They may forget to drink water, and then they potentially get dehydrated. And again, these are issues that you see in neurotypical people in grief. Appetite changes, dehydration is very common. But then in somebody with autism, again, it can be potentially magnified. And also, I mean, I'm not saying any of this is like set in stone, because it depends on the person and it depends on the loss. So many different things to look at, but I've noticed for certain, paying attention to sensory issues in grief, and in terms of like activities, right? Like funerals, or if there's going to be any travel involved, which right now in the middle of COVID, potentially probably not, but then that's another issue. There may not be a funeral. So then how do you deal with all of those things? But knowing the person and you know, how they sort of may navigate those kinds of issues already, whether or not to take them to a funeral. I always advocate for kids to be at a funeral. You may need to have extra support, because then the family is grieving too, right? So you might need to bring somebody else in to be an extra support. The kid may need to take breaks, or a teenager, who knows? Like, you know, this is all, if you're an adult, empowering yourself to say, hey, I'm not sure I can handle sitting here for this whole time. I don't know how I'm going to feel. I may need to get up and take some breaks. You know, when I work with people on the spectrum, one of the biggest things that we work with is in knowing yourself, like learning what your own limitations are, you know, how you respond under stress, and then figuring out, you know, what your sensory issues are, what your needs are, how you can communicate, like learning to be empowered to say what you need. That's a huge part of it. And with little kids, this is true too. Like OTs I always worked with had, oh God, what was that one program? How does your engine run? Like learning internally, like when you're amped up or when you're lower or when you need more support, learning how to understand what's happening in your own body. Mm-hmm. And that's important for everybody, but can be more important for people on the spectrum. And when you're grieving, that can be so different from day to day.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think that you bring up, like, so what have you noticed, like, I guess for in your book, okay, what have you noticed, like, you talk about body mapping a lot in there. Like, what are some, that's one way that you can work with some sensory stuff. Like, how else have you seen, like, people cope with grief, you know, that are on the autism spectrum? And then we'll relate it back to, you know, neurotypical. Well,
you know, one part of it is like how you talk about it. What I've noticed a lot of times, and I'm thinking about younger people right now, but it could be also true for adult people. They may have questions, talking about grief and death in concrete terms that people can understand, and not using, and I'm a big fan of that anyway. Like you don't hear me ever say somebody passed away. I just don't talk like that. I say that somebody died, and there's reasons for that. But for, you know, kids, any kids, but especially for people on the spectrum, you need to talk about this in concrete ways. And they may have a lot of questions that potentially, maybe grownups aren't prepared to answer, or they feel awkward about answering it. And that's really important to work with things like that. How do I talk about this in concrete terms that this person can understand? How do I answer their questions? So having, you're asking about how you cope, having a way to learn how to have conversations about it is really important. And maybe potentially, you know, when we talk about feelings, that can be really difficult too. I mean, let's use the body mapping in that way sometimes. It's not necessarily emotions, but you might be feeling all sorts of sensations in the body. And maybe, you know, if you're able to point that out, then it can help you get in touch with it. I also have things in the book about feelings charts, right? So like words, their pleasant feelings and neutral feelings and unpleasant feelings. So you can sort of pick, oh, hey, maybe I think I feel this way or this way or this way. We have like we write letters, being able to write a letter about to your person that has died, doing different activities. You know, a lot of people, most everybody on the spectrum has various special interests, and those change over time and over lifetimes. That's another thing that might happen when somebody's in grief. Their special interests may change. There's a person that I know whose mom died. And when she died, his special interest actually became death and grief and dying. And that was really interesting. Well, and I can't say much about that because so did mine. You know, like right. That totally happened to me. So I get it. My whole life revolves around it now. And I was hugely interested in all sorts of things. Like, and I've seen it in people I've worked with too, but it may manifest in other ways, like death related things like vampires maybe, or zombies or whatever. And that's not really scary. It's about, hey, can we talk about this? How do we bring it back to the grief? That's some stuff I do in therapy sessions a lot with people, but it's also, you know, helping families be empowered to discuss it as well, because usually it's about trying to understand what has happened, trying to understand the new reality of your world, trying to understand your own self in terms of this. And there's so many ways of doing that. And I see that a lot in the special interest stuff with kids on the spectrum and adults. I keep saying kids, because right. it just looks different in a grown person, you know?
Yeah, it looks different. Absolutely. And I think you bring up a really good point about the word, the language and the words is, you know, you were just talking about the word list. It's like, I still have to use those with like, you know, some of my adult yoga clients, you know, mm-hmm. that I see, you know, is we still have to have words around these things. And I think that that's really, I just wanted to call attention to that because we just don't know, we don't have words to describe grief, right? And I think wordless can be really beneficial, which reminds me, I was like, I should include that. I'm writing a blog right now on grief. And so just my experiences around it through COVID. And I was like, that's a good idea. I was like, I need to add that to my, my strategies because it worked for me. You know, I remember I mean, any word list, you know, I'm speaking for myself, but like as an adult who does have, you know, who can have symptoms of trauma, PTSD, you know, a lot of mine kind of depends on the day, but I can have symptoms, become symptomatic or not go through periods where I'm not symptomatic. Right. Mm-hmm. But one thing's when I am symptomatic that helps me is wordless, mm-hmm. you know, especially when I feel stuck in my body. And I just am saying that because that's normalizing. And I've seen it work with adults that just don't have acknowledgement of their social emotional world at all, regardless of whatever the function is, you know?
Absolutely.
And so since I like love to talk about universal design, I think wordless benefit everyone.
That's all I'm saying. I agree with you. Yeah, totally. Yeah, absolutely. And because there's a lot of people who, you're right, have a lot of trouble. Well, in my opinion, there aren't words to describe certain kinds of grief. That's why we have mm-hmm. so many analogies about grief. Grief mm-hmm. is like a wave, which it is, right? And it mm-hmm. comes that way. But it's like, you know, a backpack full of stones that I carry around, and every now and then I can sit it down. But, you know, over time, that backpack, I get sort of used to the weight, blah, blah, blah. I mean, there's so many stories. Mm-hmm. Or a dumbbell, you pick it up and you try to go pick up a dumbbell today of 30 pounds and start working out. You can only probably pick it up a couple of times. You carry it every day, then you get stronger. The weight itself doesn't change. So like, there's all these ways of talking about grief because I think there's not adequate words. And mm-hmm. when we talk about feelings in grief, you know, that can be even more difficult for especially people on the spectrum. And talking mm-hmm. about feelings and what they are and maybe where you experience them in your body can be very helpful. And lists are really good for this. I have there's a really great book. Let's see it. And we're in the middle of this and I'm not going to be able to find it. I think it's called The Book of Human Emotions. And mm-hmm. it talks about all these different emotions, including like words from other cultures and other places that we don't necessarily have in our culture that express really profound emotion. And I've mm-hmm. used those with clients before, people on and off the spectrum, particularly with people who have a hard time describing how they're feeling about anything, whether it's about their trauma, whether it's about grief, and then just like moving through that book and talking about that emotion, whether we've experienced it or not, and what it would be like. And a lot of times, and that opens up space to be able to recognize other emotions that maybe there weren't words for before. That can be really helpful. But you're right, like having these lists helps us to identify what we actually are feeling that maybe we weren't aware of.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. That makes total sense. And I think also something you talk about is body sensations, you know, too, is sometimes if grief, we can't find an emotion to match the grief, there's might be a sensation that can.
Absolutely. Right? Yes.
And I think that's another cool part about body mapping, which clearly I've been, in case you haven't noticed, I'm writing a lot about body mapping right now. But it's really important because if you can't find language, and lots of times you can't, like you're just going to feel it, right? Like, and you know, and I think that's the one thing you can do, you know, this going back to the yoga thing we talk about, you know, sometimes, you know, you talk in your book, Yoga for Grief and Loss, I know this isn't your exercise, it's from Patanjali and Yoga Nidra. It's the, I always forget it. It's the going between the two, the extremes, you know,
Pratipakshabhavana. Well, that is the practice of, Patanjali says, replacing a negative thought with a positive thought.
Well, right. But right. And so I'm thinking about that. I'm kind of going in circles here, but like, but you can do that in the body too. Right. And you can That's move the sensations, right? So you can, even if you can't think the thought, you can practice it in the body. Right. So yes. You could like go from one sensation and then follow it to another sensation and just follow.
Okay. This is now I see why you said yoga nidra. Cause we do that in yoga nidra. Right?
Yeah.
Through the sensations inside the body and feeling those things. But yeah, I mean, that's true. I've had a lot, especially again, kids who don't necessarily have language talking about where you have feelings, and it doesn't matter. I mean, and there's no judgment around it. Sometimes it's hard to, and I mean, sensation, when I say feelings, it's hard to describe, you know, what you're experiencing. That interoception is really a skill. This is one reason I do yoga with people with autism, mm-hmm. because they have such a hard time with that, even more than neurotypical people who also have a hard time with that, mm-hmm. of them being able to sense what's happening inside the body and then sort of giving a description to it. Is it tingly? Is it buzzy? Does it feel mm-hmm. flowy? Does it feel warm? And does it feel cool? You know, and then, you know, if it had a shape, what would it be? And mm-hmm. So, I mean, again, one autistic person is one autistic person. I have had so many people I've worked with on the spectrum that are so good at that. Like, mm-hmm. like good at that. I mean, again, there's like a judgment thing, but able to grasp that concept and really like working with that as opposed to trying to find words to describe something.
Exactly. And that's what I mean. Like finding the words to sensations, like, and, you know, and going and starting with and counting proprioception. I was just talking about this with another somatic therapist the other day. And like how much several neurotypical people discount proprioception, right? Like it's discounting, yet for every person that's has neurodiversity, it's like everything to many of them, you know, it really gets them into the body. Feeling how their body moves, and then that gets them into interoception. Like I cannot overstate how important proprioception is.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree. I mean, just thinking about all the kids that I've ever known that like the swinging and the rocking and well, just even like stimming, right? Like that movement and what that is for each person. So it's very interesting. And then again, back to grief, when grief happens, those things, even those things that may have previously felt very comforting, whether it's rocking or stimming or whatever, may change for them. And
totally.
That can be hard because this is a thing that you've been used to. Or you might see like this increase in that amount of stimulation or movement. And that's probably, you know, I think most people that I've worked with would say, it's a response to stress, but it's also a way of discharging this excess energy.
Totally. Absolutely. And I think the other thing is, sorry, my daughter's phone's going off. So I was like trying to quiet it. Woo. You know, I think the other thing is that, you know, the other thing that I've noticed in kids, like what you were saying with the sensations and the movement is it also, and it circles back to language, right? Is once we get to when we do proprioception first, sometimes, not every time, we can see the language like develop
totally
in its own way,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's why I'm like, it just can't be discounted. In fact, you know, most of the time with most people, I start with proprioception. You know, we start with proprioceptive awareness. You know, where is your body in space? Where is your, I think we do that already in early childhood. We already, we start with body parts, you know?
Yeah, and, true.
You know? True. And so I think proprioception when it comes to grief is like, it's good for everyone, you know?
Yeah.
It's good for
Like I'm telling you, the experience that I had was, it's so interesting. Like as a clinician, this is when I have my own experiences, it's a weird sort of thing because I'm also sort of watching it with this observational sort of perspective. And actually a good friend of mine had a terrible loss in her family this past week, and she's a therapist, and I called her to see how she's doing, and she's like, man, grief is weird. Grief is really weird. And I was like, I know, but she's like, this has been fascinating from the therapy perspective of just watching my own experience. I was like, I totally get what you're saying, dude. Because the same was for me. I was like, from a clinical perspective, well, I don't think I told you about this just insane flashback I had one day at work with a client. I was with a client. It doesn't matter. I won't tell the whole story, but I was able to manage it because I knew what was happening. But from a perspective of just observing what I was going through, mm-hmm. it was so fascinating to me. So when mm-hmm. I went through all this stuff with all my sensory issues and my motor skill problems and all the stuff I went through, I just was like, oh my God, look what grief has done to me. So mm-hmm. how much more must somebody who already struggles with these things be going through if mm-hmm. they're going through trauma and grief? You know, and it just was very helpful for me to see, because, you know, I don't know if we were rolling when you said this before, but this, your experience, we weren't, because you talked about how helpful it is having had your own training in mindfulness and awareness going through issues, because it just mm-hmm. helps us, you know, when you deal, and I deal with people so often who do not have very good coping skills when this kind of shit happens. And then they mm-hmm. don't know what to do. And it makes it so much more difficult. So when you learn the way to cope with it, you know, like feeling your feelings, mm-hmm. being able to be with them and know and trust yourself that you can get through them, finding ways of expression, finding people who you trust, who you know that you can, who can, will listen to you and support you, then it helps you get through the next terrible thing that might happen to you. Hopefully nothing else terrible, but you know, you live long enough, we're going to go through more and more things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, being able to learn these kind of coping skills and then watch ourselves be able to go to live through it and learn from it is really helpful. And having learned that, had that experience, I think it made me a much better therapist for people on the spectrum, but really for anybody. Cause right. now I know, and I didn't know that before, even having studied it in grad school. You know, I took a whole semester long course in counseling and death and dying and grief and bereavement. And not once did we talk about those things. We didn't right. talk about trauma. We didn't talk about what happens to your sensory processing stuff. We didn't talk about, you know, the overwhelm. We didn't talk about all of those things that happen. You sort of feel like you're losing your mind, but you're not, mm-hmm. you know? And so then yeah. again, how much more difficult is it for somebody who already struggles with, you know, issues with all the sensory aspects, potentially with communication. And another thing that came up, I talked to, do you know Haley Moss? You know who she is?
No.
Oh, mm-hmm. she's awesome. She is a lovely young lady, and she's written, I think just one book right now on the subject of autism. But she's writing a book for young adults who are like transitioning into young adulthood on the spectrum. And she wanted to talk about grief. And we had a really long chat a couple weeks ago, and it was really great. I think it's going to be a fabulous book. But she was just expressing, you know, her own difficulties in the world. And she's really successful. She's a lawyer. She teaches university courses. On autism. It's really great to like undergrad courses. It's really, she's really a wonderful, wonderful person. But, you know, she talked about how her own experiences changed in grief, and lots of things change. And then the way that she has to manage her own sensory issues in the world. And so it's such a, you're never on solid ground when you're grieving. You never know when things are going to change. And so for somebody who has difficulty with change in the first place and routine, mm-hmm. it's so much more difficult. So what are some extra things we can do for the people we work with and support or love who are on the spectrum to help them have feel more grounded, to feel more secure? And that's different mm-hmm. for everybody. And it may be sensory stuff. It might be a space of, you know, quiet. It might be all sorts of different things for different people, but communicating about it is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I like how you said grounded around it, like around the concept of grounding around people with other on the like the autism spectrum, and proprioception, because I think that's one of our tools we use, you know, we can use for ourselves and for others. And I just wanted to say that, just end with that, because I always like to end with like strategies or something that people can take away. And I was just thinking of, you know, grounding people that may not have the language abilities, you know, and I was like, in accessing the body, right?
Yeah. And what are the ways that works for this person? So again, it's back to this individuality, but you know, is it a weighted blanket, wrapping somebody up, like the squeezing, the deep pressure kind of sense of calming and the weightedness in a space that might feel really up here somewhere. So bringing people to a space where they feel that groundedness, having the quiet space if they need it, or, you know, it, being able to have the time that you need to do the things that you do that help calm your nervous system, whatever those things are. And if you are, you know, supporting people, like if you're a parent or if you're a therapist, helping people identify those things, or if you're an adult right. on the spectrum grieving, really like connecting with those people who understand you, and you learning how to say, I may need to take extra time for these things for myself, because you're going to need that.
Yeah. And I think the extra time is, I think I've never felt so much of a time as COVID or really any time where that pause is really important. I think teaching the pause, because that's mindfulness, right? Like pause. Yeah. Pause is good for any body, any brain. Pause.
Yeah.
You know, like. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I teach a lot, and this is for everybody, like I will say at any moment, and I'll ask people like for homework, practice this at least once a day. But, and for some people, I'll just like set a timer on your phone to have it go off like 3 times a day. And when that happens, pause really. And just like put your feet on the ground, put your hand on your heart and close your eyes if that's comfortable for you. Or, you know, just go inside and then say to yourself, right now, what is the most compassionate thing that I can do for myself in my grief? Mm-hmm. And then can you do that thing? If you can do it right then, go do it. If you can't do it right then, okay, how can I make space for this as soon as I possibly can? And then do that.
Right.
And that is an exercise that I really encourage people to do over and over in their grief, because you need that. And even exactly. just like, you know, this is a comforting posture. Mm-hmm. You know, or if it's even works better for you, then give yourself like a whole crossover body hug. Okay, what is the most compassionate thing I can do for myself right now in my grief?
Right. And have you ever seen Peter Levine's self-holding techniques where he does this?
Yeah. This one, And then
I love
the head. I love those too. And what's interesting is that even without having seen that, or a lot of people having seen it, people instinctively know what feels comfortable to them.
Exactly. Yeah. And I also notice when people do it, like because I do it in all my yoga classes, like people just automatically start without me guiding it. They just start feeling different parts of their body, like without me even doing it. Like cool. I saw someone the other day start with one hand on the forehead and one hand on the heart. And then she went to her belly and then she went to butterfly. I was like, great. That was like,
that's very cool.
I was like, she just like knew where her body, you know, where she wanted to go.
Yeah. The one hand on the occipital bone. Do you know, these are also Reiki hand placements.
Yeah, I know. And so is this, is another thing that I do, cause I'm a Reiki practitioner. So you can rub your hands and you can also feel. And one of the modifications that I do with some of my students in the school system that are part of the neurodiverse community is I have them rub their hands together to feel their body. And I was like,
well, yeah, look, I mean, like, here's the boundary, and they don't always know that.
Right. And so that's where the intersection of proprioception and interoception is, like, in my opinion, as a, you know, embodied, like, you know, practitioner, is the intersection between interoception and proprioception, like right here, like that is like like when I say right here, I for the that's really vague communication. I'm just rubbing my hands together, by the way, for anyone that can't see this. So just rubbing your hands together and generating heat, right? That can be that that's interoception. It's, you know, that's kind of I find that that intersection between the two is like super powerful.
Oh, well, like, you're totally right. Yeah. Yeah, I love this. I mean, it's like all, and this goes back to you, you know, you're always talking about universal design. Mm-hmm. These things we're talking about help people with autism greatly. Right. They're also helpful for everybody else. You know, so like if right. we're all doing it, then it's helping everybody.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Well, thank you so much for coming on again and talking about your work. And I just, obviously you and I, like you have all the intersections that I love to talk about and, you know, nerd out about. So
yes,
love it.
Me too. Vice versa. I just, it's great. I like talking to you. And so, you know, we'll definitely get together again.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, we'd love to have you on again anytime, doing anything, workshops, whatever. So you got it.
Okay. I'll be there. Yes.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Carla. All right. I'll end the recording. All right. It's always not.